To number nine.
We were supposed to have the balloons falling from the ceiling. I don't know. We must have had a malfunction there, Mr. Chair, in celebration. So I guess we will move on.
Okay. Consideration of funding water quality proposals, agenda item nine. Mr. Briggs.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. We could probably use those lights turned off for this because we do have some aerial photos that'll show up better if we have the lights off. This item nine is a proposed allocation of Guadalupe settlement funds for several projects, and the board's consideration of a few more projects that have been submitted. What we're going to do as far as our outline here is I'll give a little introduction about to provide a framework about how we got here, and then Michael Thomas will talk more about the low-impact development proposal as well as the other projects, with an introduction into the Central Coast Ambient Monitoring Program discussion by Karen Worster, who will follow. She's our program manager for that program. We'll have response to board questions. We'll have comments from others, and we do have quite a few cards here from folks who want to address the board. We'd like an opportunity to respond to those comments and provide a conclusion recommendation. Then, of course, I'm sure during board deliberation there'll probably be some more questions. So we can proceed. Ah, thanks. So in 1998, we had the settlement agreement with several parties, including Unocal, regarding the Guadalupe oil field, and that created the Water Quality Trust Fund as part of that settlement. It was about 30% of the settlement as far as the dollars. That settlement requires us, in terms of allocating those water quality funds, to consider factors with a geographic focus. It states in the original agreement that those funds can be used for region-wide water quality projects, and that the board can adjust the criteria after the first round of grant projects. So in the first round, which was about 99, I believe, about a year later, in terms of what the board did in allocating funds, it was about 75% in the basin, and by that I mean the Santa Maria watershed area, with the remaining 25% of those allocated funds being regional, but definitely including the Santa Maria watershed basin. That was in 99. And, of course, there was, during that period of time, those projects were, the project proponents were trying to proceed with implementation. And some were successful and some were not. In 03, we had what we called our blueprint before the board, where we said we wanted, regarding the Guadalupe Fund, where we said we recognized that there were these plans for various projects in the Santa Maria Basin, but we wanted to focus on the overriding water quality priorities in the region. And in that blueprint, it also recognized that while we knew at that point, largely because of a lot of CCAMP, our regional monitoring data, that we had significant problems from agriculture, that it stated in that blueprint that the cornerstone of proceeding with those improvements that were needed in agriculture rested with the efforts, the help of an ag water quality coordinator. And it was really that led to the board funding a position or an opportunity for the Ag Coalition to fund an ag water coordinator to focus in the southern part of the region, and more specifically in the Santa Maria Valley, to address some of those high priority issues. So the board did fund that, and we'll be talking more about where we are with that funding a little bit later today. Next. In 1904, the chair and I were driving back from, did I say 1904? Our chair just been reelected for the 119th year or something. Let the balloons fall.
That would have been Russ Jeffries.
Oh, that's a cold shot. That's a cold shot. Anyway, nothing is sacred. So in 2004, like I said, I was in the car for quite a while with the chair. We were returning from a statewide conference, which kind of one of the good things about the conference was it kind of inspired us to talk about bigger picture issues. We started talking about the very large problem that we have in the region with urban runoff and the fact that that's going to be a growing problem in the region. And we were kind of at that point in the early part of our steep learning curve and growing pains regarding stormwater control. So that, in turn, led to, if you can go to the next one there, Michael. In October of 2004, which is shortly after that, we had a board discussion item on low-impact development and sustainable land use. And the board will probably remember that's when Owen Dell came to us and we had the meeting in Santa Barbara and talked about basically the idea of maintaining the porosity of our watersheds and various ways to do that with bioswales and pervious concrete and other techniques. That got the board pretty jazzed about going in this direction. And in 2005, we had some further discussions with the board about what the priority issue should be, and the board landed on innovative stormwater, a low-impact development, I should say innovative stormwater techniques for controlling water quality impacts of stormwater, low-impact development, and the importance of monitoring so that we can get a handle on how we're doing with our control efforts, where we need to make adjustments.
And riparian.
Riparian was part of that?
Yeah.
Right. I left that out.
Yeah.
Thanks. Aquatic habitat or riparian health should have been part of that. It is part of the next one.
Right.
Okay. So we continued with our, I call it priorities articulation over the last couple years, and we have, behind us, we have healthy functioning watersheds shown up here, and we have three goals: clean groundwater, healthy aquatic habitat, which is the riparian part, and sustainable land use as our three main goals for obtaining healthy watersheds. And we have some numeric targets back that are on the wall back here behind me. But an overarching necessity is to have assessment, again, to inform us of the needs so that we know what we should be focusing on, to inform us about how we're doing, and to inform us about how we should adapt. Next. And next. So what we've done is we've recognized the board's priorities, and we've recognized that the board was interested in being more proactive in terms of how we're using the funds that are available for the board's allocation. And so we said, okay, here are a couple proposals that move us toward all three goals. And the low-impact development assistance that we're proposing today is instrumental for all three of these goals. First of all, just having enough quantity of groundwater is essential in order to have clean groundwater, and part of low-impact development is to maintain the percolating capacity of the area that's under development. And I should emphasize that we're not talking about encouraging development. What we're recognizing is that development has been happening rapidly. We're in a little bit of a slowdown right now because of the economics, but we're projected to have some pretty massive increases in urban development throughout our region. And so the idea of low-impact development is to recognize if that's going to be happening, then we should make sure that it's low-impact and still allows us to maintain healthy watersheds. So it's imperative for clean groundwater. It's imperative for healthy aquatic habitat. For one thing, if the groundwater drops and you don't have any base flow, you're not going to have much in the way of aquatic habitat at all, let alone healthy aquatic habitat. And then, of course, a low-impact development in terms of encroachment on riparian areas is a factor as well. And sustainable land use, that's really hand-in-hand with low-impact development in terms of having a sustainable watershed that still functions as a watershed instead of acting like a plastic sheet that lets all the water just shoot out of the watershed. And then as far as the assessment part, this is our assessment tool for answering these questions and informing us. Next. On kind of a bigger picture look, when we're talking about the sustainable part of healthy watersheds, you know, over here we call it functioning watersheds, which refers to functioning ecologically, but we're also talking about sustainability of watersheds. And with that note, the governor has directed the state to increase its sustainability, to reduce the greenhouse gas emissions from the state, and he's asked all state agencies to cooperate in this regard. It's a statewide effort. The Air Resources Board is the primary lead agency in terms of responsibility because of the greenhouse gas emissions aspect of it, but the governor established climate action teams that include water action teams, for example, as well as all different areas of state agencies and state government. Additionally, we have this three-region sustainability group. It's our region, the San Francisco Bay region, and the North Coast region that have gotten together on sort of a pilot basis to see what we can do in terms of the water world part of this sustainability directive to fit within governor's directive and AB 32 that was signed about a year and a half ago, which is basically California's Kyoto Treaty. And so the sustainability group has met a couple times, including day before yesterday. And that was a meeting in San Jose that I attended. And interestingly enough, this was a quote out of one of the issue papers, was the first thing that we need to do is focus on low-impact development. What can we do to support low-impact development because of the recognition of the tie-in with low-impact development and a lot of issues of sustainability? The group cited our proposed low-impact development assistance, which is before you today, as very beneficial, and they were looking forward to implementation of it. Also, the State Board Strategic Plan includes our proposal as a pilot for California, with the idea that if it's successful here, then they're looking at something to spread to the other regions, other parts of the state. So, what that all means is that not only, you know, we started with the idea of it being beneficial for our region on a region-wide basis and being essential, but what we're seeing and what I'm trying to demonstrate here is that there's potential for really leveraging this as we go forward and having it bear fruit in terms of other benefits throughout the state. Next. So Michael Thomas is going to go over the specific proposals that we're recommending today, as well as other proposals that other folks have put before you. Michael Thomas.
Thanks, Roger. Mr. Chairman, members of the board, I will briefly discuss the five proposals that are before you today, and we can you can ask questions at any time. We have the project proponents here to help answer questions or to give additional information if needed. You can go through all of them and then answer have questions, or we can stop after each one, whatever you'd like to do. A little bit of background information first. Roger mentioned the Guadalupe Settlement Fund. That settlement included $42.5 million total. There are several funds associated with the overall settlement. There's an $11.1 million fund that the Department of Fish and Game manages for inland resource protection and pollution response. There's a $4.8 million reimbursement to the Department of Fish and Game for costs incurred. There is a $9 million restoration fund that the Department of Fish and Game and the Coastal Conservancy manages. And there is a $15 million water quality fund. There are several other smaller funds, but I'm not going to mention those. Today we are talking about the $15 million water quality fund that the Water Board manages. We're not talking about any of the other settlement funds. A couple of important things. There is a requirement that the Water Board must allocate these funds to water quality type projects, and the consent judgment describes what those are, gives lots of examples, and those projects must be within the Central Coast jurisdiction, within the Central Coast region. There are criteria to be considered, and they are listed here. They are not requirements, they are considerations. and the board can change those criteria if it decides to do so. This is an overview of the lower Santa Maria Valley. I'll have some photos that are, I think, easier to read as we, easier to see as we go along. This is the city of Santa Maria. This is Orchid. This is Napomo. Santa Maria River. Santa Maria River Estuary. This is the Guadalupe oil field, where the cleanup is ongoing. Oso Flaco Lake is here. And I already mentioned the estuary is here. The first project we're going to talk about is Paradise Beach, which is a few miles to the south. The second project is Avila Ranch, which is a few more miles to the north in Avila Bay. This is a close-up of the same area. There's the city of Guadalupe, the Guadalupe oil field, Point Sur, and the Paradise Beach properties here.
Point Sal.
Point Sal, I'm sorry.
And it's 1904.
So here is Point Sal, and this is the Paradise Beach property. It is 143 acres. It includes about a half a mile of beach. The total price to purchase, the total purchase price is $2.15 million. The property is bounded by County of Santa Barbara property to the east, Bureau of Land Management property to the south, and private lands to the north. Access is through dirt roads, so it is a relatively pristine property. Here's an aerial view. Point Sal, the property is approximately here. We're looking north towards Santa Maria Estuary, which is here. The California Coastal Conservancy just approved $1.25 million for the purchase of this property. The Land Conservancy has proposed that the Water Board allocate $900,000 to complete the purchase, and staff is recommending approval. In 1998, the Board allocated $2.5 million for the acquisition of properties like this from the Guadalupe funds, and staff then developed a contract with the Nature Conservancy to complete these types of purchases, and there are several requirements that must be met, including ecological preservation of the property in perpetuity. And this, the submittal by the Land Conservancy meets all of the requirements. I mentioned that it's relatively pristine, and one of the reasons we want you to approve this project is that we want to keep it in a pristine state. The pressure to develop coastal properties like this only increases over time, and this is a significant opportunity to preserve a good-sized chunk of coastal property, including the beach. What we're looking at here are tide pools or intertidal areas that are located on the southern end of the property, and they are in relatively pristine condition because of the limited access. So this would be there is a water quality aspect to this. By protecting the property, we're protecting the intertidal and near coastal areas.
How many acres was that?
143 acres and approximately a half a mile of beach. So we are recommending approval of this proposal.
So question, Michael, that land is in private hands at the present time?
Yes. It is owned by a family, the Gregnini family, I think, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. And they have agreed to sell it to the Land Conservancy for preservation.
Could I ask you?
Yes.
How's the land being managed right now?
Well, Bob Hill with the Land Conservancy is here, and I think he would be the best person to answer that.
Thank you, Mr. Thomas. Good afternoon, Chairman Young and esteemed members of the board. My name is Bob Hill, Conservation Director with the Land Conservancy of San Luis Obispo County. The question was, how is the property currently being managed? The owners live in the Central Valley, Don and Irene Gragnani. They essentially are not managing the property at all. However, it's an unfenced property, and the neighboring ranch family looks after the property on an informal basis.
Do they graze it?
It's really not suitable land for grazing. It's coastal dune scrub habitat.
All of it?
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's correct. Okay. So we have the beach, steep bluff, dune scrub, and maritime chaparral behind it, so it's not really grassland or suitable for grazing.
Okay. Can you tell me what... So the Land Conservancy would take title to the property?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. What provisions do you have for managing the property in perpetuity? In other words, more specifically, I don't see any endowment money coming with this. So how are you going to pay for fencing, for removal of invasive species, or protection of the dunes?
Sure, those are all great questions. I'll answer it in several parts. First and foremost, we will initially take title of the property. However, we're also in discussions with County of Santa Barbara about taking long-term ownership and management responsibilities for the property. The reasons for that are several. One is that they are already the existing neighboring landowner to the east and to the southeast. They own approximately 400 acres there as well. So they have a long-term commitment to the property and to management there as well. In terms of management decisions, what kinds of things will happen there? The entire Point Sal area is subject to what's known as the Point Sal Reserve Area Management Plan. It was funded by the State Coastal Conservancy and adopted by them as well as by the County of Santa Barbara. Like many management plans, it discusses the need to balance permanent conservation of the outstanding natural and cultural resources of the site, while on the other hand balancing that with recreational opportunities. In this particular case, on consideration of the outstanding natural and cultural resources, the plan skews heavily towards protection of those resources as opposed to allowing for recreational access. As Michael pointed out, there are two grant facilities proposed for this acquisition, one the State Coastal Conservancy, the other one being considered by your board today. Both the Coastal Conservancy and the Regional Board require, as a matter provision of the funding, that we record what we call essential deed provisions. So the deed provisions state that the property can be used for no purpose other than the purpose of the grant. The property cannot be used for mitigation or for security of debt, and that the deed provisions are a servitude running with the land. So thus, when we take title, concurrent with the close of escrow, the property will be permanently deed restricted, and any successors will also be bound by those same deed restrictions.
But do the deed restrictions get specific enough to, say, for example, prevent a future recreation plan on the property from running ATVs all over the dunes?
I think what would have to happen there. So these are good questions. The deed provisions state no purpose other than the purpose of the grant, which is spelled out in the grant agreement, that the property shall be maintained primarily in its scenic, natural, open character. Additionally, the Point Sal Reserve Management Plan does not contemplate any off-road vehicular access. So it would take reopening that management plan and a new environmental document commensurate with that, I would think, to open it up for that.
But the management plan doesn't actually impose a deed restriction on that property, does it? Not really.
You're correct. So we would be relying on the essential deed provisions, and of course your board could choose to add additional provisions.
Well, I would say it would be a little more a little stronger protection if some of those deed restrictions were spelled out before another manager took over it. And I mean, it's great to have multiple use and all that, but we've seen instances where recreation can be defined very broadly to the point where you could destroy the dunes. Or you talked about deed restrictions. You didn't talk about deed prescriptions. And to the extent that those are not spelled out, what about the requirements for the subsequent land manager to remove invasive species or to do some fencing or those kinds of prescriptions? A lot of these deed restrictions whether they're easements or others, they are proscriptions, but they don't require active stewardship. And I would say that if we're going to get ecological services out of this property, we need to realize that we have to be active managers.
Yes, I agree with all of your statements. I would have to say that at present we're relying on the management plan adopted and the deed provisions that I described. So in order to affect the kinds of prescriptive land management that you envision, there would need to be additional affirmative obligations placed on the grantee to do that.
So okay. How can we do that? It's not going to happen now, is it?
Well, one thing you can do is specify today what conditions you would impose on granting the money, I can work with this gentleman and whoever to review those and either bring them back to make sure you agree with them or make sure that you've defined what you want.
Thank you.
Leaving it in an open and natural state is a little too loose. Yeah, I mean, you could interpret that in different ways, and I think it should be tightened up.
I'm certainly of the opinion that we should make sure that we do it right and protect the, again, outstanding natural and cultural resources that are found on the property.
Okay. I think the principle here is that it isn't over when there's a transfer of title, and that's actually when things begin, and I'd like to make sure that we're cognizant of that fact.
Well, what would you like to see?
I would like to see deed prescriptions as well as more specificity on the deed restrictions so that that language about maintaining an open and natural state also specifies that's going to take priority over activities that will degrade the natural character and ecological functions, whether it's the actual structure of the dunes or whether it's the species assemblages that are there. On the prescriptive side, I would like to see things like specifying that whoever is managing the property will monitor ecological conditions, will take action to remove invasive species, will take action to fence as appropriate or burn as appropriate, whatever the suite of land management tools there are, they ought to be affirmatively, prescriptively required. And now, beyond that, my real concern is that there'll be money to pay for that. And so I would even consider, I don't mean to open a can of worms, but if there's some way to set aside some money for ongoing stewardship or to at least to have some more assurance from you or from the County of Santa Barbara that this is not going to get a half-time volunteer docent every other year. No, seriously, this is. If you look at, I'm not kidding. If you look at the state parks staffing for properties, you'd be shocked at how many properties are only visited once a year, much less actually managed. So, if we want to make a claim that this property is actually going to serve the purpose of the settlement, it needs to be actively managed.
Yes, Dr. Press, I take your comments to be good comments. I should add that my particular land trust, Land Conservancy of San Luis Obispo County, a large part of what we do is physical land restoration. So that means that we employ on staff a licensed herbicide applicator who has the expertise and the competency to eradicate non-native invasive plant species such as veldt grass, beech grass, and pampas grass are the three primary invaders in this coastal dune scrub environment. much of the work we do in the dunes there is funded through the other settlement portion that Mr. Thomas mentioned, which is through the State Coastal Conservancy and the Department of Fish and Game under the auspices of the Dunes Collaborative. So we have enjoyed funding over the past several years to do invasive species work. Counterpart to that work are rigorous scientific monitoring of the results of our application. So we employ a full-time restoration ecologist who sets out transects and line transects so that we can go back and see with statistical evidence that we've achieved success in our invasive species control. That would also be consistent with the manner in which we administer fencing projects and the manner in which we look at maintaining riparian corridors, et cetera. So we have the, in my opinion, we have the funding, the experience, and the competency to manage and carry out the activities that you describe.
Okay. Mr. Shallcross.
Sort of to go along with that. One of my concerns here is you mentioned there were some near pristine tide pools.
That's correct.
Okay, and we know what happens when tide pools, when there's a lot of accessibility to tide pools, they become incredibly degraded rather quickly. And so if we're going to be, putting money into something because it has great tide pools, I think there needs to be something in there to protect those tide pools. And I don't know how accessible this is currently, but looks like a neat place to go.
Yeah, I can address those concerns as well. The property is very remote and difficult to get to. Ostensibly, there are two ways to get to it. From the top of Brown Road, which means it's a several-mile hike downhill and back uphill in loose sand, or you can hike along the mean high tide line from the Santa Maria River to the property, which is also several miles each way in the sand. So although their access is possible, it's always going to be a big hike, which means that most people won't go to the trouble to get there. But indeed, we have a documented marine mammal haul-out site on the property, as well as a documented oyster bed, also the botanical and cultural resources I mentioned before.
How about a deed restriction that said no road on the property? No motor vehicle. Well, that might be impractical for management, but maybe.
Well, except for management.
Yeah.
Except for management.
Except for management, right. Right. That way you won't have in 10 years, somebody cutting a road through it to provide public access. Anyway.
Okay. Mr. Hodgson.
It's always very hard to be opposed to protecting some pristine property. As Dr. Press pointed out, there is a cost side as well. And so I think as we're thinking about these things, we have to think about the fact that we have a great deal of public property that we don't have the money to make use of. And the state parks system is a good example of that. Also, each time we do something like this, we are taking property off the tax rolls, and that means that each and every one of us will have to pay something more just to maintain the status quo. And then there are operational costs, and we also know who's going to have to pay for that. That's each one of us in the room. I don't know that I'm opposed to this, but it just seems to me that I keep seeing more and more projects like this, and I wonder how on earth our children are going to pay for it.
What does happen to the property taxes on this? Right now we've got private ownership, and so they are paying a tax. When you take title to it, what happens?
That's a good question, and I appreciate your asking it. The Land Conservancy of San Luis Obispo County, like every other land trust, is a private nonprofit corporation. Therefore, we are also subject to property tax as well. However, in San Luis Obispo County, at least, nonprofits are often able to apply for what's called a welfare exemption, which means a reduced property rate. However, the property would remain on the tax rolls. Relative to long-term maintenance and operation, it's not unusual at all and transactions like the subject to also locate additional funding that can be put aside in a restricted account, ostensibly a management endowment, that can ensure maintenance and defense of that property in perpetuity.
Dr. Hunter.
I think it's important to keep in mind that the Land Conservancy of San Luis Obispo County has established a very strong program, and they've been in place for a number of years, and they've carried out some really major projects and work. So I think the experience and knowledge and capacity to set up a plan that looks to the future in terms of how they're going to achieve their goals, I have confidence that they will maximize and leverage this investment, and that they will deliver on the goals that they've spelled out. Can you tell me, Mr. Hall, how long the Land Conservancy has been in place in San Luis Obispo County?
Yes, thank you for asking. We've been in business for almost 25 years now. We were incorporated in 1984, and we're looking forward to celebrating our 25th year anniversary next year.
Okay. Any more discussion on this particular proposal? Because we can put together our heads if we want to add, you know, language for this proposal at the end when we've heard everyone's comments, if that's what we want to go with. Anything else with this?
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
The discussion about the stewardship and
yes.
costs. The Water Board set aside $2.5 million for the purchase of properties like this, and if the Board approves this proposal, they will have spent $2 million or will have allocated $2 million. There's $500,000 remaining that's currently in an endowment. It's still in the Guadalupe Fund. It hasn't been taken out of the fund. The organization that has been using the proceeds from that or the interest from that is the Dune Center, and the staff are currently reviewing that arrangement, and that is it is a possibility that we could come back to you with a proposal to reallocate that $500,000 towards stewardship.
That would be a very interesting proposal. I'd like to see that.
Well, I thought if we went with staff's recommendation across the board, that there would be very little left of what's remaining.
The $500,000 is not included. That is part of the $2.5 million package. So we're not talking about that $500,000.
Okay. All right. Do we have other properties, you know, with...
This would be the third acquisition with these funds.
Yes. Okay. I served as the project lead on both of the other acquisitions under this particular contract, and each of them are currently being managed by us for natural resource protection.
And how do you get money to do that?
That's a good question. as a local land trust, my trust enjoys donations from within the community. Obviously, we enjoy grant facilities such as the one being proposed today for acquisitions of properties. But a primary component I mentioned before is we do physical land restoration. So when we do land restoration, whether it be repairing a creek that's eroding or blown out, or repairing a wetland, or working on invasive species, those are usually four-fee sort of contracts where we make billable hours. You know, we earned income ostensibly, so we can use that income to manage our properties over the long term.
Has there been any identified endangered species on that property now?
There's one species that's documented that is a candidate for federal listing, and that is botanical resource Cercium rhodophyllum. Common name is the surf thistle. It occurs nowhere else other than in the Guadalupe Napomo Dunes.
Are there any roads on the property at the present time?
There are some very poorly maintained, very sandy jeep roads. There's one that accesses from the county parcel into this parcel. I would say that it's virtually undrivable because it's very, very loose sand.
Are there problems with erosion control now?
Not that I'm aware of on the property. Again, we're dealing with sandy soil, so of course we'll have erosion problems in many places, but the steep bluffs, for example, that frame the property are very well vegetated and stable.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity to address your questions.
Sure. Mr. Thomas.
Okay. Lights on. Okay, we're going back to the north now. Reorientation here. Here's the Guadalupe oil field, City of Guadalupe, Santa Maria River, and to the north is Avila Bay, and the Avila Ranch project is right about here. More close-up of the Avila Ranch project and the surrounding area. This is Avila Bay. The community of Avila Beach is here. Point San Luis, Diablo Canyon Nuclear Power Plant is here. Montana de Oro State Park. And again, Avila Ranch is here. It is approximately 2,400 acres of land. This is a close-up. Avila Bay again and the ranch. Just to the north is the Hibbard Preserve, which is owned by the Land Conservancy of San Luis Obispo County. The Avila Ranch is currently in a 160-year lease, and that lease has development rights. The American Land Conservancy is in contract to purchase that 160-year lease for $24 million. They are also currently negotiating the underlying fee title with PG&E. PG&E owns the fee title, and PG&E also owns this land surrounding the Avila Ranch. PG&E owns approximately 12,000 acres in this area. The ranch includes several sub-watersheds. There, you can't see them on this diagram, unfortunately. The contrast is it's not good enough. But there are three streams that drained to Avila Bay and a fourth that drains to the coastline. This is an aerial satellite image of the general area, and I'm going to zoom in a little bit here. Some more of a close-up. The ranch includes part of this watershed, which drains directly to Avila Bay. It includes most of this watershed, most of this one, and part of this one. This drains to the coastline. The rest drain directly to Avila Bay. This is the road that leads to the Diablo Canyon Nuclear Power Plant. The proposal, the long-term proposal here is to combine Avila Ranch with the Hibbard Preserve, as it states in the proposal, and to create a new state park that would encompass approximately 4,000 acres. This is a different view of Avila Bay. Now we're inland, looking towards the ocean, towards the southwest. This is Highway 101 here on the left, and you can see the development occurring, going to the west, north, as you move away from Highway 101. Avila Ranch is located here. This is the Avila Golf Course. Avila Beach is here. This is the old Unical Pier, which is now the Cal Poly Pier. And you can see that development is occurring in this area and is moving into these canyons. And there have been several development proposals for the Avila Ranch, and purchasing the 160-year lease would preserve that property, at least for that time. And if the underlying fee title is obtained, then it would be protected in perpetuity. Unlike the property we just talked about, this is a state park, so there would be some recreation activity associated with it. And Carol Blakesley with the American Land Conservancy is here today. I'm sure you will have several of the same questions that you just had. Okay. And that's it for my presentation on that. So if you'd like to ask questions before we move on to the next project.
Mr. Shallcross.
How much time is left on the lease?
160 years.
Oh, there's 160 years from now.
Yes, I believe it was 190 years when it was established.
And then if the underlying fee isn't purchased, then anything can happen to it. And do state parks want this?
Yes.
I mean, They haven't been real anxious to take on more parks. Oh, really?
Good afternoon. I'm Kara Blakesley. I'm a volunteer for American Land Conservancy, and we're the organization that has Avila Ranch under contract. And in answer to your question, the original lease is 199 years, so we think there's about 160 left. And state parks, as you know, is under a lot of budgetary pressures now, and there's even been talk about closing parks. And the political winds are still moving on that question, but state parks is definitely behind this project. In fact, I have a list of supporters, and at the top of the list is Ruth Coleman. And although it hasn't gone to the state parks board, hasn't gone to Public Works or Department of Finance, Ruth Coleman and their staff has unofficially committed at least $6.5 to $7 million from a pot of money that was awarded for the Irish Hills, particularly under Prop 12. So, yeah, they are interested in it. One of the reasons that State Parks is willing to take on this in light of all the other problems they have is that this is a very easy piece of land to prevent public access at all. There's no coastal access. It's right next to the road. If you cross the road, you're on the beach. But to actually get into this property, you have to go through a gate. It's very easily closed. And so what will probably ultimately not be incredibly popular to the local community is their plan is on day one to open up the gates and set up a kiosk so that visitors to this park would have to pay a user fee upon entering. The other interesting thing to them about this property from a pure revenue perspective, there's also lots of other things that are wonderful about it, but from a pure revenue perspective, there's already water on the property and sewage treatment facilities. And so their long-term goal is to put campsites, which although in the short run can be an outlay of capital costs, ultimately can be a way for a park to sustain itself. So State Parks is actually very interested in this property.
Dr. Press?
Back to the lease a little bit, because I'm a little confused. There's 160 years left on a lease. So who had the lease first?
It's a very complex history. Only our attorney truly understands the nature of this. Okay. But I do understand that the lease was severed from the fee some time ago, and the lease is held by a limited partnership, and the underlying fees hold by PG&E. How it came to be, I'm not entirely clear, but in 160 years, the lease would fall away, and then fee title would be held by PG&E.
But what we're being asked here is to approve paying the lease, is this $950,000 going to pay 160 years worth of lease, is it a one-time? Because if the lease, are we buying it? Are we buying the lease from someone?
Yes.
And it's a one-time purchase, right?
Correct.
Okay. So, all right, that's clear. Now, if indeed it does is purchased in fee, suppose it was purchased in fee in 3 years. Would the fee purchase reimburse the lease purchase?
Well, this is how I would put it. The appraised value of the underlying fee is $0 because there are some rights associated with that fee, but they don't come into play for 160 years. All the uses of the property are tied up in the lease. So when you buy the lease, you essentially have all rights of ownership until year 161. But just as a side note, I'll add, the state agencies, in particular State Coastal Conservancy, wants to acquire not only the leases, which have all the commercial market value, but also they want to see us acquire the underlying fee from PG&E. And that's why there's really two negotiations going on right now. One, we're buying the $24 million value attributable to the leases from the leaseholders, which is the Patchell Limited Partnership. And then we're also negotiating separately with PG&E on doing a swap of interest so that they can give up the fee title. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the State Coastal Conservancy has said, unless and until we get both interests, they're not going to support the funding. So they support the project on the condition that both things happen simultaneously.
Yeah, it's a little paradoxical, though, because you're saying that because the leaseholder has the development rights on it, that the underlying fee is zero, but you're willing to pay $24 million for the underlying fee.
No, we're not paying anything for the underlying fee.
No, I know you're not, but State Parks would.
No, State Parks is paying $24 million, which will go solely to the Patchell Limited Partnership. There won't be any State Parks money going to PG&E.
Okay.
sorry.
All right.
It is very confusing, and a lot of people, when they first look at this property, they feel uncomfortable with it. But I think you have to step back and try to have a big vision. This is 2,400 acres of amazing land, and I'd love to take you out there and prove it to you. But unfortunately, the only way we can protect it is to establish both things. We have to, one, acquire the lease interests, which have all the ability to develop and destroy the natural resources of the property now. And then we also have to seek that underlying fee title from PG&E so that in 160 years between then and perpetuity, we're also preventing development.
So
but we can't just do one. We have to do both.
And the urgency here is because the development, well, there's development pressure, but there are other potential leaseholders or lease buyers.
If we don't succeed in closing escrow within our contract period, which is right now September of 2008, the partnership is going to be putting this property on the market, and they will be selling it at fair market value. And its highest and best use is a result of its being able to be developed in an ag cluster, which is possible given the number of parcels and the size of the property itself. So the development potential is very real, and what is exactly why we're here,
okay,
to prevent that.
So are we being asked to allocate funds without the condition that the fee is going to be purchased within the near term?
Well, yeah. Matt, I'm sorry.
The way we wrote the resolution, it says that the allocation is conditional upon the American Land Conservancy obtaining the full purchase price for the lease.
The fee.
The full purchase price to purchase the
lease. Yeah, fee. I'm concerned about the underlying fee interest.
Mm-hmm. But it sounds like there's no, very little guarantee or very little probability that the $24 million would be raised by any group of entities to purchase the fee by September, whatever it is.
Well, purchase the lease.
No, the fee. I'm saying the fee. That there's some urgency about the lease, but the fee could go on, the process of acquiring fee title could take a long time.
I think it's true that it's going to be complicated to acquire the underlying fee, but what I might suggest, if you want to have a comfort level with this, and I would too if I were in your position, is either make it conditional, your grant conditional upon our receiving the underlying fee, or even better from our perspective, is give us maybe an extra year to pull that together. I'm not sure we can get the fee and the lease wrapped up by September, but I am willing to say give us maybe by the end of September to lock up the lease. How would you do that, though? I don't know exactly how you'd set it up, but we'd be willing to make it conditional on us locking up the fee.
But isn't it also, I mean, aren't you in effect saying that regardless of the fee acquisition, that you're getting 160 years of protection for $950,000. So that's another way to look at it. It's not a bad deal.
That's how we looked at it.
Yeah. Right?
I think it's a wonderful deal.
Okay.
If you put in $950,000, we are going to match that by $23.1 million.
No, but even if you don't, for 160 years, there's protection.
Absolutely.
For just that $950,000, right?
Yes. Another way to look at it is if we don't solve our environmental problems by then, none of this matters.
As Barry Commoner said, that if environmental issues are a fad, they'll be the last one.
And the one other little tidbit I might add is that we know that this underlying feed is owned by PG&E, and we understand that PG&E has a lot of interest in keeping the nuclear power plant operating. At some point in the next 160 years, I think it's probably reasonable to expect that at some point they may be willing to turn over the fee for something else that they want. I don't know. That we're not counting on, and we're actually in negotiations now to close this by September. And one thing I would add, too, is this project is extremely complex, and we acknowledge and accept that. In fact, that we tried this once before, and it didn't close before. But American Land Conservancy was able to pull off the Hearst deal, and people said it was impossible. So if you would be willing to give us a little faith, I feel very confident that we're going to make this work, because we do have support right now of the state agencies who do have the acquisition money to fund this.
Okay. Mr. Shellfrost.
Yeah, I'm a little confused. The $950,000 is just our
portion.
It's
our
yes, portion.
The lease is going to cost $24 million?
Correct. We have to raise $24 million by fall of this year.
No, the fee.
No, the lease.
Oh, really?
Yeah, there's no fee being bought. It's
right. I think the resolution be clarified that if the board were to approve this, would be $950,000 conditional upon acquiring the full $24 million for the purchase of the lease.
Right.
And the way it says it, it's a little bit unclear.
Right.
So what's expiring in September?
Our contract. So if we don't raise the money by the end of September, we lose our option to purchase.
So in other words, our part would be the board's part would be $950,000. The conservancy has to raise another $20 million.
And what happens if you?
And if they don't, we get the $950,000 back, and we go do something.
Right.
You
and
actually you never allocate.
Correct.
You never
right. It never gets
transfer.
Allocated. And
right.
And how much have you raised so far, not counting the $950,000?
Well, yesterday we raised $350,000 from SLOCOG,
well, no,
which
just
is an
total.
Initial one.
Total,
if you consider this grant and a couple things that are pending.
No, not considering this grant. Total without the $950,000.
And total pending or total absolute in the bank?
Both.
Okay. In the bank, we have about $350,000.
Okay.
We have unofficial commitments for another $12 million right
okay.
now.
And I hope you have other prospects.
We do.
To close that significant gap.
We welcome additional prospects, but we do
have
some very good prospects.
No, you have prospects.
Absolutely.
In mind, not that you welcome them.
Absolutely. This project is going to be funded by State Parks, State Coastal Conservancy, and we're hoping Department of Fish and Game / Wildlife Conservation Boards. All those state agencies have bond acquisition money.
Okay. All right. Any other board questions or comments?
I have one question. So what would, after all this is said and done, what is the underlying fee going to be?
If it's all said and done, the underlying fee and the leases would collapse into one fee title interest.
So you get the whole thing for?
$24 million.
Including the fee?
Correct.
Okay.
Mr. Hodgen.
Just want to verify that the ultimate use for this property, as far as you're concerned, is to turn it over to the state park system.
That's correct.
Okay. And so this will give them some additional property to have to manage.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay. Any other board comments or questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Thomas?
Yes. In closing on this one, the board did allocate more money than this to the purchase of this lease several years ago. It was a little over $1 million from the Avila cleanup that the board allocated to the purchase of this lease. And it was Kara Blakesley who negotiated that agreement and was successful in negotiating that agreement with the lease owner. It was after Kara moved on that the deal fell apart. So she said, if you have faith in us and trust us to do this, you know, that or asked that you did. And we know Kara from working with her previously on this project and do have faith in her ability to put this deal together. That was one of our major considerations.
Not going to move on again.
Well, I don't know. Okay, returning to Santa Maria. This is the City of Santa Maria here.
John, can you hit these?
City of Santa Maria here is the Guadalupe oil field again. North is straight up. This proposal is to properly abandon 12 monitoring wells left over from a previous water board investigation. The board allocated funds from the Guadalupe account to install wells in this area, southeast of Santa Maria, several miles southeast. And the purpose was to find out if the oil fields in this Cat Canyon area were causing groundwater degradation over a larger area than the oil fields. And the answer is no, they're not. So we need to properly abandon those wells, and we estimate that it will cost between $60,000 and $100,000 to do that. Where just in case, we're asking the board to allocate up to $120,000 to properly abandon the wells, and if any funds are left over from that allocation, that they would, along with any other leftover money that remains in the account from interest earned or whatever it may be, that we consider allocating that to the watershed coordinator position that the board previously approved. And I'm not saying that at this time the board makes a decision to allocate funds to the watershed coordinator position, because it's pending our review of their submittal, which we have right now, and we're reviewing it now. And if it doesn't go to that, then it goes to CCAMP, the monitoring program.
Can't we apply for cleanup and abatement funds or some other state board fund to do this?
Yes, we could.
How likely that we might have that request granted?
I don't know. I think it's, in my experience, it's impossible to predict
right.
whether they will grant funding from the cleanup abatement account. But yes, we can do that.
Yeah.
I hadn't thought of the cleanup abatement account.
I'd rather use their money than our money. Well, maybe they'll ask, maybe they won't.
Somewhere else.
Yeah. Okay. Anything more on this one?
No, that's
okay.
it.
Any board questions on this proposal? All right.
Okay. Just making a note about the cleanup abatement account. Okay. Moving on. The two remaining proposals are the Low Impact Development Center and CCAMP. Looking at Santa Maria again, this is the city of Santa Maria, and this is Orchid, and downstream we have Guadalupe and the Guadalupe oil field. I want to emphasize these land use activities that are occurring here and the scale on which these land use activities exist and the impact that these land uses have on water quality in this area. We know from our sampling program that we have major toxicity problems around the city throughout the ag areas. And as you can, these are waterways, these blue lines, and the red dots are our sampling locations. We have major toxicity problems throughout this area, downstream and in the Santa Maria Estuary and in Osoflaco Lake. These areas are highly toxic. We have quite a few toxic hits or hits of toxicity, and we have several sites where the toxicity is 100%, meaning that everything that you put in there dies. So we have a major problem here, and it exists on a very large scale. And this is one of the reasons why we are emphasizing projects that are on a larger scale and not selecting projects or not recommending projects that would do work on a very small scale. As I mentioned, we want to apply action and direct our resources to projects at the appropriate scale. This is a message that we are sending to potential grantees across our region. It may seem like we are picking on certain proposals or on the Dunes Collaborative proposals in this case, but actually we're picking on everyone across our region. We have turned down quite a few proposals that are similar to some of the proposals that were submitted for consideration today. For these same reasons, we're trying to get more local groups, nonprofit groups, and agencies to work together to apply for projects and participate in projects that exist on a larger scale so that they can affect the actual sources of degradation. Also wanted to emphasize the future growth areas around Santa Maria. Santa Maria has thousands of acres in their area of influence. They have plans for tens of thousands of homes. We just, well, not just, a few months ago, we reviewed an EIR for a 6,000 home development. That's just one single development, and it's near the airport. If you look at their sphere of influence area, you'll see several sites or several areas around the city that are designated future growth areas, and they include plans for thousands of homes. We went on a tour of the area. The managers from the office, managers and supervisors, went on a tour of the Santa Maria area a couple months ago to get a firsthand look at some of the problems that we are seeing in our CCAMP monitoring program, and they are pretty serious. We have major problems with trash and, as I already mentioned, water quality problems such as toxicity.
So, Michael, let me interrupt you. Where are we in terms of the city swamp? Have we issued one to them?
We have the county of Santa Barbara swamp. We have not issued a swamp to the city of Santa Maria.
The city is a separate permittee.
And where they are in the schedule, I can't tell you off the top of my head.
Okay. I think that was relatively...
They're first.
They're relatively soon in the schedule, and that was the one where we talked about combining that with Lompoc.
Right. Okay.
And the reason being, the reason that they are higher on the list or first on the list is because of this pending growth that is going to occur in this area. And it's important to realize that whatever happens up here determines the fate of the Santa Maria Estuary, the Santa Maria River, and the various waterways that drain this area. The water quality problems that we're seeing are caused by these land use activities. And as the city grows and urban sprawl occurs, the problems only get worse. And that this is an example of why we are proposing funding for the Low Impact Development Center. I want to briefly mention two of the major programs that the board is implementing to deal with these two land use issues that we see on the screen behind the wording here. I'm sorry that is just not projecting very well. The first is the stormwater program. We are implementing more and more comprehensive stormwater management plans, or requiring more comprehensive stormwater management plans. The board is well aware of this. It has taken up many, many hours and days of board time. Staff is also defining low-impact development and hydromodification controls and design principles. We're working on that right now. We are about to send that out to municipalities, and when we do, we are going to get a lot of feedback from them, and we're going to hear about it, and so will the board, because this is our attempt to get up to speed, and other regions have already started doing this, and we're a little bit behind the curve, but we're going to get up to speed pretty quickly here, and we're definitely going to get some feedback from the municipalities, because it's going to be a major step forward for us. We have large-scale education and outreach efforts ongoing. We have this proposal to fund the Low Impact Development Center. CCAMP has played a major role in the stormwater program in justifying the board's requirements and in directing our priorities. And we also have enforcement as a tool to implement the stormwater program. The irrigated ag program, we will be bringing a permit renewal to the board in early 2009. We're starting to work on that now. We realize that irrigation efficiency is one of the biggest issues that we face with irrigated agriculture. We are designing a grant right now that will include thousands of growers, tens of thousands of acres of irrigated ag land, and multiple stakeholders in the process, in addition to farmers. Farm groups and other organizations are coordinating with us to implement this project. We're working on the grant now and securing the funding, and it looks pretty darn good.